Tonight we want to talk about profiles of the new song, and you have the other side of your sheets if you brought them along. A certain Christian school went to visit Mayflower 2 at Plymouth Rock. Have any of you ever toured that little replica of the Mayflower? Okay. Well, if you ever toured it, try to imagine 100 people living there for 2 months with all their equipment that they needed to bring, even the animals they planned to bring. I don't know what animals they brought, but if they expected they would need a cow, they brought it along, and it was in that space with them. And they were there for 2 months. So one of the students said to the guide, asked the guide, what did they do all that time? Well, he said they spent a lot of time singing. Well, what did they sing? Well, they were Reformed people. They sang mostly psalms. And then he made this interesting comment. He said they sang through the week however they wanted to sing the songs. They could sing harmony if they wanted to. But on Sunday, they sang only the melody. That was the rule. Now, it's a little hard for us to understand the church having that much influence on how and what people sing. But that goes back the whole way to the beginning of church music. Now, I want to talk a little bit about history tonight, because get a little bit of space here. If you have only the present, and you're trying to make a decision, I don't care how much good thinking you have, you can go anywhere with that future course in life. But if you can establish a reference point in the past, you can with some certainty make a good projection into the future. And that's why history is so terribly important. And so I want to acquaint you a little bit with history tonight. The Bible says, prove all things. Hold fast to that which is good. Abstain from the appearance of evil. Now I'm going to give that in the Amplified. But test and prove, that means it's not going to happen immediately. You're going to have to do some work here. But test and prove all things until you can recognize what is good. To that, hold fast, abstain from evil, shrink from it, keep aloof from it, in whatever form it takes. I think that really applies to music. It might not be immediately apparent what the answer to the question of music is, and so we should test, and we should prove, we should work to find an answer to what is right. The early church understood the importance of good and bad music. They knew that the world had music to which they danced. That music they did not want. And so their concern was not to have any metrical, regular rhythm, because people who had rhythmical music could dance, and they didn't want that to be any possibility. So for 1,000 years, they prescribed church music to be unmetered. It was called the plain song. Have any of you ever heard a plain song? Now, they weren't sure the equipment was going to work. Give it a try. Not happening. I'm so sorry, because I wanted you to hear this. It sounded very much like the Amish sing. It had a little different quality. In fact, very, very beautiful. You would have enjoyed it. And so sometime try to access a plain song and play it and listen to it. But there was no way that you could have danced to it. You can't even tap your foot to it. It has no meter. It has no regular rhythm at all. And that was the prescribed music for the church. There were thousands of plain songs written. They also didn't want people to get any credit for them. So we don't know who wrote them. They were all done anonymously. And then that began to change in the Reformation. I'm trying to show you where we've come from and why. The church was concerned particularly about what rhythm does to music and to people. And so we come into the Reformation period, and Martin Luther basically was the one to introduce metrical music into the church. And believe it or not,
Calvin, as strict and austere as he was, permitted metered music at Geneva. And we have some of his music, and we're going to sing one of the songs, and you'll see how sensual it is. Would you turn to number 80? We're going to sing one verse of this. I don't want anybody dancing, but see if you can tap your foot. Do ye nations round, keep it, earth rejoice. Yeah, you can tap your foot to that. How many of you ever thought that was a bad song? That was bad music. Well, Queen Elizabeth, when she heard those tunes from Geneva, she said, now you must remember, the Church of England was still singing the plain song. She had never heard metered music. And when she first heard this music, she said, these are Geneva jigs. Those people down there in Geneva are dancing. Now, I see some of you smiling, and that's what I wanted. I wanted you to see that the concern people like that would have had have long since gone by the board with us. We're used to metered music. Now I want to make my comment. We can accept metered music, and it has this benefit. If you're going to sing the plain song, you have to memorize how much time to hold each note and how to move to, the whole thing has to be memorized. And that's one of the reasons why the music finally was taken from the congregation and sung by special choirs, because it was very difficult to sing some of those plain songs. And so with metered music, we can know exactly how much time to give to each note. We can put out a new song and everybody can sing it together, because the meter defines how we sing and how much time we give to each note. So it's a good thing. But we take a tremendous responsibility to make sure that the meter doesn't do what the church originally was so concerned about. And that is create a sensual response. Okay? Now, it wasn't just the church in history that was concerned about that. It was philosophers, pagan philosophers, who were interested in the moral quality of their people who were concerned about it. Galileo, y'all know who Galileo was, this is what he said. Give me a nation's music, and I'll tell you what will be the outcome of their race. You have some quotes on there. Andrew Fletcher, a Scottish politician, said, "Let me write the songs of a nation, and I don't care who writes their laws." That's a pretty strong statement. And I will stop here to say that if you want to know why this nation went down, the main reason why it went down was because of the music. The Beatles said, and I don't know who was listening, but I've read the quotes. Our music is designed purposely to create two effects: to create rebellion and to remove inhibitions, especially in the area of sex. They said that. And that's exactly what happened. And it doesn't matter what laws are made, the music of this nation demoralized the nation. And that's the reason it went the way it went. It wasn't the laws or the lack thereof. It was because people were demoralized by 30 years of that sensual beat that the Beatles and Elvis Presley and those people introduced. Plato. The introduction of a new kind of music must be shunned as imperiling the whole state, since the styles of music are never disturbed without affecting the most important political institutions. Aristotle, the student of Plato, music directly represents the passions or states of the soul. If one listens to the wrong kind of music, he will become the wrong kind of person. Now, we have introduced to our thinking in our generation that music is morally neutral, that the music itself doesn't have any particular effect. It's the words. We can borrow any music we want to borrow just so we have good words put to it. Well, I want to do something. I want to sing two tunes, and I want to ask you something. This is the first one. La la la, la la la, la 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 la. Here's the second one. Do 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 do. All right, ladies, which one would you play to or sing to your children if you were putting them to sleep? How many would sing the first one? How many would sing the second one? Huh? Not one. The music itself carries a message. What about this? And it's in my hymnal. But listen to the music and think of the words you're singing when you sing this. And the reason I put it in there is because this music does fit the last two verses, but it does not fit that first part of the first verse. And I cringe every time we sing it. And I really debated whether I was going to put the song in my book because of it. Here it is. I was sinking deep in sin, far from the peace. Really? Is that how you want to think about sin? It's a lark. It's lots of fun. I was sinking deep in sin. Now, the rest of it says, oh, my heart to... That fits. But that first part of that song does not fit that music. The music is totally at odds with the song. Now, in the Bible, we have an incident where Moses and Joshua were coming down from the mountain, and they identified problems in the camp just by the music they heard. I'll read it to you. And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, there is noise of war in the camp. And he said, it's not the voice of them that shout for mastery, neither is it the voice of them that cry for being overcome. But the noise of them that sing do I hear. And it was the music that first introduced them. There was something really wrong going on in the camp. And what I'm trying to say to you, and they probably weren't even able to hear the words. They were just hearing the music as they got close to the camp. So there is such a thing as music itself that is demoralizing. That's the point I'm trying to make. The psalmist says, I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined unto me and heard my cry. He brought me also up out of a horrible pit, and that language means a pit of noise. That's literally what that means, a pit of noise. Out of the miry clay, and set my feet upon a rock and established my goings. And he's put a new song, which tells us there is such a thing as an old song, has put a new song in my mouth, even praise unto our God. So what we want to look tonight is what happened. So the church accepted metered music. And then the people who wrote that music wrote it in a certain way, which I'm going to illustrate after a bit. And for a number of years, several centuries, they wrote music that had its own integrity. It was not sensual. It had rhythm to it. The rhythm served its purpose, but it did not dominate to the point where it created sensuality. And it had a classical style, and I'll describe what that is in a few moments. The change came in the 1800s. That was when the gospel song came into existence. And that happened right here in the United States. There were three things happened in the 1800s that gave rise to the gospel song. People never sang music like we had in the 1800s. Now what happened was, you had the Methodist camp meetings in the South. Think about it. You had a crowd of people, 1,000 people maybe, no songbooks. Most of them at that point were illiterate, couldn't have read them if they had them, and couldn't have read the music. And so people were writing songs to be sung in the camp meetings. And so what kind of song do you write? Well, you write a song that's more repetitious, so it's easy to learn. You write a song, after all, it's a camp meeting, and you want to get up a real spirit of enthusiasm. So you write a song with a little bit more emphasis on the rhythm. And you write a song with a refrain, so if people can't sing the stanza, at least everybody can join in and have a rallying refrain. And so the definition, the general definition of a gospel song is a song that has a refrain. Hundreds of those songs were written, but they probably would not have gotten into the hymnals if we hadn't had the next thing that happened, which was the Sunday school. The Sunday school originated in England, but it flowered here in the United States. Again, you have hundreds of children, no songbooks, children who couldn't read if they had songbooks, and so again, you have a whole lot of these songs written easy to learn because of the repetition. They're children, they like rhythm, so a little more emphasis on the rhythm, and of course the refrain, so all the children can join it at the end. At the end of the Sunday school movement, you have the revival movement of Moody and Sankey and all their associates. Again, you have thousands of people. Many of them, they did not have songbooks in those early meetings. They later did. And again, you have hundreds of these songs written, and they began to come into the hymnals. Now, there was a man. His name was Lowell Mason. He was a musician. He was a classical musician. And he said, if this trend of more rhythm and more repetition continues, it will corrupt church music. If he were living today, Lowell Mason would say, I told you so. The stock gospel song was the first step down the slippery slope that music went. Now, if it had stayed at a certain point, it would probably not have been the danger that it was. And so some of those gospel songs are wonderful songs. Great is Thy Faithfulness is a gospel song. As far as I'm concerned, it's a hymn. It should be in our hymnals. When Peace Like a River, It Is Well With My Soul. That, to me, is a hymn. So there are wonderful gospel songs that are hymns, but they're gospel songs. And there's another problem with them. It's not just the music. It's the theology. Do you remember I told you they were written for revivals? So the subject of many of them, not all of them, there were some written after that that took up subjects like cross-bearing and so on, but not many. Most of those songs, we sang one of them this evening, is about getting saved and going to heaven when you die and how wonderful heaven's going to be. Well, that's part of our theology. We should sing some of those songs. But we began to have hymn books that was mostly what we sang. You need to get saved so you can go to heaven. Well, that's true. But aren't we going to sing about discipleship, obedience, cross-bearing, suffering, non-resistance, non-conformity? Are we going to sing our full theology? Or are we just going to sing those songs about getting saved and going to heaven when you die? Well, I guess if you believe it's all by grace, and see, that all came in there too, that whole shallow theology was in those songs. And it grieved me that the church was tending more and more in the direction of those kind of songs. In fact, something that happened that I wish somebody would have stood up and raised a voice. When the church changed from German to English, the hymn book that made that change was the Church and Sunday School hymnal. How many know that hymnal? Of course you do. Well, that was a change not just from German to English. That was a change from singing good old German Anabaptist or Pietistic songs sung to good choral melodies to these gospel songs sung to these cheaper melodies with this cheaper theology. And I don't know why somebody, when that happened, didn't say, wait a minute, wait a minute here. This is a change in our theology. This is a change in our the effect that music has on us. It appeals more to our feelings than it does to the things we should be thinking about. Well, somebody did think about it. It was John D. Brunk who compiled that book. By 1926, he had time to think about it. And he decided to come out with a new church hymnal. How many are familiar with the 1927 church hymnal? Oh, come on, some of you are. That's the hymnal I grew up with. That was the new hymnal after the church and Sunday school hymnal. And John D. Brunk said, look, I think we should just sing hymns in the church. I don't think we should sing the gospel songs. I think if you want to sing them, let's sing them during the revival meetings, during the street meetings, the other meetings. But in the church, regular church services, we should sing just hymns. So he compiled a hymnal with just hymns. And Harold Press said, we'll never be able to sell this hymnal because people are already singing the gospel songs from the Sunday school and church hymnal. And so in order for this book to be accepted by our churches, you're going to have to put some gospel songs in. So they prescribed that 20% of the songs in that church hymnal had to have a refrain, which that's the definition, the general definition of a gospel song. So if you go to the church hymnal and you count, 80% of the songs are hymns, 20% of the songs are gospel songs. I looked at that and I said, you know what? That has served the church very well. So if you go count in this hymnal, you'll find that 20% of the songs are gospel songs and 80% are hymns. And I will say this, please keep the emphasis on the hymns, especially the hymns of praise. It really, really disappoints me if somebody gets up and leads Take Time to Be Holy for the first song. That is not a song of praise. That's an instruction song, and it's a good song. We should sing it. But I think most of our singing should be pure praise, and so I just loaded that book with praise. And then the instructional song should be sung if we have somebody teach a lesson on holiness. Okay, now let's sing Take Time to Be Holy. But let's start off our services with at least two or three songs of just pure praise to God. I'll just give that for you song leaders. And the instructional songs. And we should sing some gospel songs, but a little bit like the rhythm, we can say, okay, we're going to sing these, but we're going to sing them with discretion. We're going to sing them with an understanding that if we really put the emphasis there rather than on the hymns, we're going to go in a certain direction with our music. And so I would like to call you to say, look, we're going to sing hymns. We'll sing a few gospel songs with discretion. We shall use rhythm with discretion and keep our singing in a way that is God-honoring. I had a good friend at Shippensburg University. She was in the music department there. In fact, I don't know if she was the chairman, but she did a lot of the decisions. She was an old Episcopalian lady. She wasn't an Anabaptist lady. And she said, John, the whole thing is in the beat. If you want to know what good music is, there it is. What are they doing with the rhythm? Are they using it constructively to help people sing together? Or are they using it to create a sensual effect on their feelings and their response? And this is how she would say it. She would say, John, the beat has swallowed up the song. Okay? The beat appeals to the physical. The melody appeals to the spiritual. And the emphasis should always be on the melody. When somebody sings, joyful, joyful, we... Now, that has a rhythm to it, but the melody is what you remember. And that should always predominate in any song. All right. Well, where do we go from here? So, like I told you, Lowell Mason and his associate, Thomas Hastings, set out to counter this trend, this gospel song trend. How did they do it? Did they get up and rail on people and say, you need to quit singing? No, that's not what they did. They're a little bit like me. I don't spend much time talking about bad music because I don't like to talk about things like that more than I have to. I believe it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. And so they did that. They tried to prove by their music writing that you could write a hymn that was just as easy to learn, just as delightful to sing, as any gospel song, and yet it was still a hymn. And so what do we have from them? These are the songs they wrote. Joy to the World. Ah, we love to sing that. Rise, Glorious Conquer, Rise. When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. Hark, 10,000 Harps and Voices. We sang that this morning. I'll Praise My Maker. To Thy Pastures Fair and Large. Lo, what a pleasing sight. Near my God to thee. My faith looks up to thee. These are the tunes that Lowell Mason wrote, and he did it on purpose to make them very simple. Some of my friends don't like them. They said they're too simple. They like songs that are more complicated. Well, he could have written those, but he deliberately wrote these very simple, appealing melodies so people could enjoy singing hymns better than they sing gospel songs. Well, I want you to think now about how a song should be constructed. Now, when I was in the university, we took a lot of communication courses. We took speech, we took composition, we took all kinds of courses where you communicate. And in all of them, they emphasized four things you have to do to communicate well. Number one is you should have a theme. If you write a paper, there should be a clear subject that's addressed the whole way through. You don't just wander from one thing to another. You have a clear subject. Or if you're speaking, you should have a clear subject. And then, in order for people to remember that subject, there should be repetition.
not just the same thing over and over again. It should be varied. If you do the same thing over and over again, you'll end up with a response like the preacher who asked his wife on the way home, "Do you think the people understood my message?" "Oh," she said, "I'm sure they did, because all of them were nodding." So the variety not only adds interest, it also helps you look at the theme from different angles, and it broadens it. It does all kinds of interesting things to the theme. And so what you have is you have a theme. If you're listening to a good sermon, you have a theme. It's being repeated with point one, point two, point three, and they all are saying the same thing from a different angle. See what I'm saying? So it's this repetition helps you remember. It's the variety that helps to keep your interest and also broadens the theme and gives it more depth and more richness. And then finally, there should be a conclusion. I often in the store would say to my family, "Would you listen to this music? It never goes anywhere. In fact, it isn't even a melody. You couldn't even sing that melody. It's just a bunch of chords that just keep going and going and going. It doesn't go anywhere." But a good song introduces the theme. It repeats the theme with varied character. And then it finally concludes. So now what I want to do is spend a certain amount of time looking at some wonderful pieces of music. Would you put the first one up? I don't know where you're putting it. Oh, over here. All right. This is number one in many hymnals. And in doing this book, I went through dozens of hymnals. And this song, I would say, appears in every hymnal. I want you to notice when it was written. It was written in it's a Wesley song, written in 1787. And the music was written in 1769. This song is almost 300 years old. Now, why does it endure? Many of the songs that people are singing today will be gone tomorrow, and they'll be replaced by more of the same kind of shallow music. But this has an enduring quality, and we're talking about the music, not just the words, because many different words have been put to the same music. But that musical composition has an enduring quality because it obeys these principles. I want to show it to you. Here we have a theme. So, mi, do. And then we have this. Okay? Here we have this expanded. And then we have so, mi, do. It doesn't do the same thing here. It goes down to here. And then it does this, which is similar to this, only with different notes. This is do, re, mi, fa, mi, re. This is re, mi, fa, mi, re, do. Does it again. Does an inversion of the theme. Instead of so, mi, do, it's do, mi, so. And it has the highest point. Now we're getting to the conclusion. It has the highest point in the soprano and then the highest point in the tenor for a double conclusion. Just a complete song, a little theme, repetition that's varied with a conclusion. And when you sing it, you have that sense that this song has integrity. It's not just a bunch of repetition without variety that doesn't really have a very strong conclusion. It doesn't really say very much, I'll add that. So let's sing it. You listen to this. Do mi so. Come now, O Christ. I'm going to do an expanding version of this.
Help us, I need to see. Help us to pray.
Yes, with different notes.
Father, all glorious, or all victorious.
That's the thing.
Amen.
But if you see a hymn that has lasted a long time, you go looking and you'll see at least some of these elements that are used. Let's sing the last verse.
To the great one in three, eternal graces be, and evermore, his sovereign.
song every Sunday for many Sundays before somebody would say, please, could we sing something different? It just wears well. If you sang Heaven Came Down the Door Filled My Soul for 10 Sundays in a row, you would have people complaining all over the congregation. It's just not the same kind of song. So let's have the next one. Now this is an old basin song. A very simple song. But it does all of that. Here's your little theme. A half note and two quarter notes. And then it does this. And then you have a half note and two quarter notes. It's the same pattern with different notes. And it ends differently. This is different from this. Then it goes back to this and actually repeats it. It actually repeats this with a different ending. The highest note in the soprano in the whole song, and the highest note in the tenor of the whole song. A very simple song. It does everything that I just described to you. And our congregation sang this song many times before this hymnal was published, and it was a great favorite of our congregation. We never got tired of it, and you won't either. Now, how many know this song? It's 141 in your hymnal. But I think we can just sing it, okay?
Glory, Father, and friend, thy
Lord, thy God.
Repeat
it.
Bring through all the works of the sweet sea.
The petition. Sustained by this delightful thought. And what is the delightful thought? Since thou, their God, art everywhere, they cannot be, for thou art not. I cannot sing that without feeling a tremendous amount of emotional gratitude and thankfulness to God. Let's sing all the verses so you can look. We had a visitor at our church one time, and this is a very simple song, and he came to me after the service and said, where in the world did you get that song? I didn't remember where I got it, but he was so impressed by it. Very simple little song, but a whole lot more depth than any gospel song, and a whole lot more appeal, as far as I'm concerned, than any gospel song. Let's sing the second verse.
Thy voice is sweet. Amen.
There's nothing excessive about it. It's all balanced. It all does what it's supposed to do and has the effect of being the best way to communicate, according to what psychologists say, not just God. Okay, let's have the next song. This also is Gold Mason. Here's our little theme. A scale-wise interval. Now, some of you, this is going to be a bit above your heads, but just hang on. So it doesn't go do, re, mi, it goes do, mi, do. It skips a re. And then it has a pattern is four, three quarters, a dotted quarter, an eighth, and a quarter. And you'll find that the whole way through. Well, there it varies. But you basically find that pattern the whole way through, okay? With different notes. I mean, here's the same pattern with different notes, okay? And then, of course, it comes down here, that's the sort of an inversion of that theme. And then you have this repetition of this pattern here and here, okay? Again, you have an inversion of the theme here. And you have the highest note in the soprano, the highest note in the tenor. And interestingly, this is a key change. That adds another variety, and you don't even think about it. This is the key of C, this is the key of G, it goes back to the key of C. If you're listening, you can hear that key change. It just, I don't see how these people did it, but they wrote these songs with amazing musical integrity. And we love to sing it, and that's why, because it's written in the way it's written. Do, so mi, do, rise, glorious sky. This is where the key changes.
Amen.
want to emphasize one more thing that I said earlier that I don't want you to forget. These songs had a deeper theology. And if you sing the hymns, you get our whole theology. If you sing just the gospel songs, you basically get what I've been calling the Save Me Gospel. It's all about me getting to heaven and how wonderful heaven's going to be. And that's part of our theology. I don't want you to misunderstand that. But that's not all of our theology. And we should be singing it all, and we should be singing songs that have musical integrity. They will have a tremendously wholesome effect on our people. Now, what I would like to do is pick up some more hymn stories as a conclusion. I maybe should ask if you have any questions or any disagreements with what you heard. Brother Ben. Well, the general definition is it has a refrain, okay? And that...
Sing one or something. I would like to hear the difference.
Okay. Blessed assurance, Jesus is... Sing it. Blessed assurance,
Jesus is mine. Oh, what a fullness of glory divine. Heir of salvation, purchase of God, born of His Spirit, washing His blood.
This is my story. This is my song, praising my Savior all the day long. This is my story. This is my song, praising my Savior all the day long. It's about your personal salvation. This is my story. It has the extra emphasis on the rhythm with the repetition in the music and the text. Is it a bad song? No. But it is a step down a certain direction that the church went. Does that make any sense? A little bit. Okay. That was a good question. Anybody have more questions?
Yes, I said.
Go ahead.
A gospel song is one we sing to each other, encourage one another. A hymn is sung to God.
Yes. And you were going to say something more, Ben. Emphasize the hymns.
No, if we put a lot of emphasis on praise songs, oh, what is going to keep the younger generation to go into the contemporary praise songs?
You're talking about a certain genre called worship and praise songs. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about hymns that give praise to God, like Come Thou Almighty King, Help Us Thy Name to Sing. I'm not talking about the genre that they call worship and praise, which is, yes, these light songs that just repeat over and over again. No, I'm not talking about that.
But isn't that easy to shift into that if you put too much emphasis on just praise?
If you sing the hymns out of the hymnal, probably you're not going to go in that direction. That was the whole purpose of my hymnal. I saw the church shifting more and more, and I won't name the hymnals people were using, but they were shifting more and more to the lighter hymns, and I said, wait a minute, we have to reverse this direction. And so this hymnal was an attempt to win people back by giving the hymns the best tunes I could give them so people could enjoy singing them. And I just want to emphasize, keep the emphasis on the hymns. And we'll sing some of them here. Would you turn to, I have a hymnal, yes. Would you turn to 632? Ray Palmer was a very busy man. He was trying to study for the ministry. He was working at a clothing store. He was teaching in a girls' school. He was working in the church until he was finally thoroughly exhausted, and he became very discouraged. One evening, he took out his little Morocco notebook, and he wrote this song to try to deal with the issues in his life. A few months later, Lowell Mason was doing a new hymnal, and he stopped him on the street and said, Mr. Palmer, would you have a hymn to contribute to my new hymnal? Ray said, well, maybe. So he pulled out his little Morocco hymn notebook and showed him this song. And Lowell Mason said to him, Mr. Palmer, you will do many things in life for the Lord, but you will be remembered by the song, My Faith Looks Up to Thee. Let's sing verses 1-3. While life's dark maze I tread, that's what he was struggling with, and griefs around me spread, be thou my guide. We'll sing verses 1 and 3. Though my faith looks up to thee, number 616. Now this is a gospel song, but here's the story. They tell me that the Cleveland Harbor, the channel from the harbor to the port, is a very rocky channel, and they have the channel marked by lights so that a ship can safely navigate without wrecking on the rocks. But you have to look at this song to see that it was written in 1871. Before electricity, those lamps were oil lamps, and there had apparently been a storm, and all of the lamps along the channel had been blown out. The light from the lighthouse was still there. The ships were still attracted to the harbor, or to the port, but there were no lights to light the channel. And so here are the words. On a dark, stormy night, when the waves rolled like mountains and not a star was to be seen, a boat rocking and plunging neared the Cleveland Harbor. "Are you sure this is Cleveland?" asked the captain, seeing only one light from the lighthouse. "Quite sure," replied the pilot. "Where are the lower lights?" "Gone out, sir." "Can you make the harbor?" "We must, or perish." With a strong hand and a brave heart, the old pilot turned the wheel, but at last in the darkness he missed the channel. And with a crash upon the rocks, the boat was shivered, and many a life was lost in a watery grave. Brethren, the Master will take care of the great lighthouse. Let us keep the lower lights burning. We often sing this song, and people don't realize what they're singing. But what it is saying is Jesus attracts people. If I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto me. But many people don't make a successful landing because there's nobody there to tell them lessons of discipleship, to help them safely navigate the channel so they can carry their Christianity through their whole life to the end. And that's where we come in. And it's saying there are many people who make shipwreck because there's nobody there to light the channel. Let the lower lights be burning. God will take care of the lighthouse. Let's let the lower lights be burning. Let's sing one verse. Dark the night of sin has settled. Let's sing it. Second verse.
Don't so. Dark the night of sin has settled, while the angry billows roll. Eager eyes are watching, longing for the lights along the shore. Let the lower lights be burning, send them gleam across the way.
Now, these are just the last six verses of a very long poem written by John Greenleaf Whittier, and some of you know who he was. He was an abolitionist, opposed to slavery. He was a Quaker man who was used to a quiet meeting where people did not make a lot of fuss. And one night he went to a revival meeting, a very raucous revival meeting where people were practically out of control, shouting and waving their handkerchiefs and whatever all else. And as a Quaker, he was thoroughly disgusted. And on the way home, he decided he was going to write a poem to expose what he thought needed to be exposed. So he wrote a poem called The Brewing of the Soma. And his point in this poem to show that people all through the ages have used artificial means to psych them up to some spiritual high. And he goes way back in the history of India to the Soma plant, S-O-M-A, where they took sap and they fermented it and they distilled it and they made themselves a drug that caused them to have the high they wanted. And then he brings it down and says, every age has come up with something. And then he applied it to the revival meetings, that this is an artificial high that people are trying to create. And so I'll just read some of it. The faggots blazed, the cauldron's smoke up through the green wood curled. Bring honey from the hollow oak, bring milky sap, the brewer spoke in the childhood of the world. And brewed they well or brewed they ill, the priests thrust in their rods, first tasted, then drank their fill, and shouted with one voice and will, behold the drink of gods. They drank, and lo, in heart and brain, a new glad life began. The gray of hair grew young again. The sick man laughed away his pain. The cripple leaped and ran. Drink, mortals, what the gods have sent. Forget your long annoy. So sang the priest from tent to tent. The Soma's sacred madness went, a storm of drunken joy. I'm skipping some stanzas. And in that childhood's early year, each after age has striven by music, incense, vigils drear, or trance to bring the skies more near or lift men up to heaven. Some fever of the blood and brain, some self-exalting spell, the scourger's keen delight of pain, the dervish dance, the Orphic strain, the wild-haired Bacchant's yell. And yet the past comes round again, and new doth old fulfill. In sensual transports wild as vain, we brew in many a Christian fane the heathen soma still. Dear Lord and Father of mankind, forgive our foolish ways. Reclothe us in our rightful mind. In purer lives thy service find, in deeper reverence praise. In simple trust, like those who heard beside the Syrian sea, the gracious calling of the Lord, let us, like them, without a word, rise up and follow thee. O Sabbath rest by Galilee, O calm of hills above, where Jesus knelt to share with thee the silence of eternity interpreted by love. With that deep hush subduing all, our words and works that drown the tender whisper of thy call, as noiseless let thy blessing fall as fell the manna down. Drop thy still dews of quietness till all our striving cease. Take from our souls the strain and stress, and let our ordered lives confess the beauty of thy peace. And let's sing the last verse. Do so me, breathe through the heats of ...629. Charlotte Elliott was a very bitter woman. She had been a writer of humorous verse. She was a portrait painter. She lived in high society. She made lots of money and lived with the party group. And then she was struck by a strange illness at the age of 30 and became a complete invalid. And she was bitter against God. A famous evangelist called Caesar Millan came to visit the family to see if he could help her. And at the supper table, she went on a tantrum of railing against God, her family, and the church. Her family was so embarrassed, they got up and left the table, and he was left there with her. And he said, "You're tired of yourself, aren't you? You're holding to your hate and anger because you have nothing else in the world to cling to. Consequently, you are sour and bitter and resentful." "Well, what's your cure?" said Charlotte. "It's the faith that you're trying to destroy." "Well, how shall I come?" "Come just as you are." And she did. Years later, her brother, she was an invalid, she couldn't do anything. He was trying to raise money to start a school for poor children. She wrote this song. It was sold all over England and raised more money to build the school than all of the bazaars and all of the sales they had to raise money. And this song ever since has been, of course, a favorite of all of us. You folks sing it during revival meetings, and rightly so. We sing it during communion. We often sing this song on our knees, singing, "Just as I am, thy love unknown hath broken every barrier down. Now to be thine, yea, thine alone, O Lamb of God, I come, I come." Let's sing verses 1, 5, and 6. And on verse 5, let's do a switch of the soprano and the tenor. By the way, I wanted to say, when part singing first was done, the men sang the soprano, and the ladies sang the high tenor, just like we're singing it. So I like to do that occasionally. No, verses 1, 5, and 6. "Just as I am without unbelief, but that thy blood was shed for me, and that thou biddest me come to
except for the ones up to age 20, you keep these parts. Ready? Last verse. "Just as I am, my love unknown hath broken every barrier down. Now to be thine, yea,
I suggest you analyze this song. It fits that pattern. It has musical integrity, and that's why the tune just wears so well, and we sing it and sing it and never get tired singing it. Would you turn to 805? We'll just do two more. On July the 2nd, 1881, our 20th president, James Garfield, was shot in a train station on his way to a class reunion, and he lived for 4 months. And during those 4 months, the nation was in grief. This song became a song sung all across the country, or it probably would not be in our hymnals. It was written by a lady who had her own grief. Her name was Mary A. Baker. A strange illness had struck the family. Her parents had both died, and she was bedridden as a result. And her brother, hoping to escape the disease, went to the West to a drier climate, hoping to recover, and soon he died as well. And she said, "God, why did you do this to me? I've tried to serve you faithfully all my life, and I don't understand why you took everything from me." She worked through that, and a few months after she finally had worked through her bitterness and struggle with her situation, a friend came to her and said, "Why don't you write a song about the storm on the Sea of Galilee," which reflected her experience. And you see it in verse 2. "Master, with anguish of spirit, I bow in my grief today. The depths of my sad heart are troubled. Awaken and save, I pray. Torrents of sin and of anguish sweep o'er my sinking soul. And I perish, dear Master. Oh, hasten and take control." So we have this song because of two very unfortunate incidents: the sorrow of her own life and the tragedy of a president that was assassinated. It's interesting how our hymns have come to us and how they have been written and how they have been preserved. So let's sing verses, let's sing verses 1 and 3. Now, sopranos, when it says, "The master of ocean, earth, and skies," a few of you need to sing that high so. That just really adds to the emphasis there. Do so, master, the tempest is raging, the billows are crashing high, the sky is closing number 894. Charles Wesley wrote hymns on every conceivable subject. His purpose was to write hymns to call attention to every aspect of the gospel. He wrote 6,500 songs. The Wesleys were energetic people. They had a passion for their country and for the fellow citizens. We visited England a few years ago, and there was one place I wanted to go. I wanted to go to the Wesley Museum. And if you ever go to England, but do not miss the Wesley Museum. And you will see the evidence of men who cared about every person in their society that had a need, and they met as many of them as possible. John Wesley, well, let me read a little bit about him. John Wesley traveled 250,000 miles on horseback, averaging 20 miles a day. Now, I don't know what that, I'm not a horse person, so I guess that's a lot. Averaging 20 miles a day for 40 years. He preached 40,000 sermons, produced 400 books. Some of those were pamphlets, they weren't very large, but 400 books. Knew 10 languages. At 83, he was annoyed that he could not write more than 15 hours a day without hurting his eyes. And at 86, he was ashamed that he could not preach more than twice a day. And he complained in his diary that there was an increasing tendency to lie in bed till 5:30 in the morning. Now, if you don't get enough accomplished in life, you just didn't try hard enough. They were indefatigable workers. They just really were. Now, this song is based on Matthew Henry's comment on Leviticus 8:35, which is Moses' last charge to the priests. And this is what he said. Therefore shall ye abide at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation day and night, 7 days, and keep the charge of the Lord that you die not. Matthew Henry says this, we shall every one of us have a charge to keep, an eternal God to satisfy or to glorify, an immortal soul to save, and to provide for one generation. I'm sorry, let me read this again. We shall every one of us have a charge to keep, an eternal God to glorify, an immortal soul to provide for, and one generation to serve. And he ends with this very sobering warning. If I my trust betray, I shall forever die. Remember Jesus said, he that breaks one of these least commands shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. And you remember I told you that the dregs of society is the person who teaches lies. It's a sobering responsibility we have to carry forward a gospel that will last for many generations. We see many people who are handling this very carelessly. So this song is a very serious, sobering reminder of our responsibility. A Charge to Keep I Have is one of my favorite songs. The music to me is just absolutely moving, and it has a very sobering message. No soul, a charge to keep I have.
To serve the presence.
So what is the takeaway from this evening? We may have metered music only if we're willing to take the responsibility to use that in a constructive way and not allow it to degenerate into something sensual and destructive. We may sing the gospel songs with discretion, remembering what they are and the trend that they set and the result that finally ended up by people who were not careful, and sing them with discretion, sing them much less sparingly than the hymns, but let's emphasize the hymns that give us a total theology and music with integrity. Shall we bow our heads for prayer?